Well, welcome, good evening, and welcome in particular to the 6th Miliband Lecture on Inequalities, Problems and Challenges. We've had a last term, Anthony Giddens, John Hills, Gotte Espig Anderson, this term Barbara Ehrenreich and Polly Toynbee, Branko Milanovic, and this evening we have Nancy Fraser. So thank you so much for coming. Nancy is Professor of Philosophy and Politics at the New School and co-editor of Constellations, an international journal of critical and democratic theory. She's the 2004... I'll just bring it closer to me. Is that better? Is that better? Okay. Shall I start again? Or did you get most of that? Okay. The 2004 holder of the Spinoza Chair in the Philosophy at the University of Amsterdam. She is currently a fellow at the Wissenschaftskolleg in Berlin, a wonderful place for academics to work and semi-retire for a year and enjoy Berlin and Simon Rattle. Her books include Redistribution or Recognition, Justice Interruptus, Critical Reflections on the Post-Socialist Condition, Feminist Contentions with Shayla Ben-Habib, Judith Butler, Drusilla Cornell, and Unruly Practices. And among the books she's edited are Pragmatism, Critique, Judgment, and Revaluing French Feminism. The recipient of many fellowships, endowed lectureships, and awards, Nancy Fraser's current research is on the post-Westphalian democratic justice. And she'll lecture tonight on this theme to the title, which should be behind me. It is Reframing Justice in a Globalizing World. And Nancy is going to, we're sitting down this evening because that's quite formidably awkward and high. And I think if Nancy was behind there the whole time, we wouldn't see her at all. So we're going to do all the presentations from this desk. Please join me with me in giving her a very warm welcome.
Thanks very much, David, for that very generous introduction and for the invitation. It's a great honor to be a Miliband lecturer. I unfortunately never had the pleasure of meeting Ralph Miliband, but I was and am a great admirer of his work and really of the vision and integrity from a political point of view that he expressed. So it is truly an honor to deliver a lecture named in his honor. I want to begin with a very, very minimal notion of globalization and being sitting next to one of the great authorities on how best to conceptualize globalization. I say this with a bit of trepidation. I want to simply start with the idea that whatever else it means, globalization is changing the way we argue about social justice. Not so long ago, in the heyday of social democracy, disputes about justice presumed what I shall call a Keynesian Westphalian frame. Typically played out within modern territorial states, arguments about justice were assumed to concern relations among fellow citizens, to be subject to debate within national publics, and to contemplate redress by national states. This was true, I think, for each of the two major families of justice claims, claims for socioeconomic redistribution and claims for cultural or legal recognition. At a time when the Bretton Woods system of international capital controls facilitated Keynesian economic steering at the national level, claims for redistribution usually focused on economic inequities within territorial states. Appealing to national public opinion for a fair share of the national pie, claimants sought intervention by national states in national economies. Likewise, in an era that was still gripped by a Westphalian political imaginary, which sharply distinguished domestic from international space, claims for recognition generally concerned internal status hierarchies, appealing to the national conscience for an end to nationally institutionalized disrespect. Claimants pressed national governments for an end to nationally, pressed national governments to outlaw discrimination and to accommodate differences among citizens. So in both cases, the Keynesian Westphalian frame was assumed. Whether the matter concerned redistribution or recognition, class differentials or status hierarchies, it went without saying that the unit within which justice applied was the modern territorial state. Now, of course, there were always exceptions. Occasionally, famines and genocides galvanized public opinion across borders, and some cosmopolitans and anti-imperialists sought to promulgate globalist views. But these were exceptions that proved the rule. Relegated to the sphere of the international, they were subsumed within a problematic that was focused primarily on matters of security as opposed to justice. The effect was to reinforce rather than really to challenge the Keynesian Westphalian frame. That framing of disputes about justice generally prevailed by default from the end of the Second World War through the 1980s. Although it went with unnoticed at the time, the Keynesian Westphalian frame gave a distinctive shape to arguments about social justice. Taking for granted the modern territorial state as the appropriate unit and its citizens as the pertinent subjects, such arguments turned on what precisely those citizens owed one another. In the eyes of some, it sufficed that citizens be formally equal before the law. For others, equality of opportunity was also required. And for still others, including me, justice demanded that all citizens gain access to the resources and respect they needed in order to be able to participate on a par with others as full members of the political community. The argument focused, in other words, on what should count as a just ordering of social relations within a society. Engrossed in disputing the what of justice, the contestants apparently felt no necessity to dispute the who. With the Keynesian Westphalian frame securely in place, it went without saying that the who was the national citizenry. Today, however, the Keynesian Westphalian frame is losing its aura of self-evidence. Thanks to heightened awareness of globalization or transnationalization, and thanks as well to post-Cold War geopolitical instabilities, many observe that the social processes shaping their lives routinely overflow territorial borders. They note, for example, that decisions taken in one territorial state, such as my own, often impact the lives of those outside it, as do the actions of transnational corporations, international currency speculators, and large institutional investors. Many people also note the growing salience of supranational and international organizations, both governmental and non-governmental, and of transnational public opinion, which flows with supreme disregard for borders through global mass media and cyber technology. The result is a new sense of vulnerability to transnational forces. Faced with global warming, the spread of AIDS, international terrorism, and superpower unilateralism, many people believe, and reasonably so, that their chances for living good lives depend at least as much on processes that trespass the borders of territorial states as on those contained within them. Under these conditions, the Keynesian Westphalian frame no longer goes without saying. For many, it's no longer axiomatic that the modern territorial state really is the appropriate unit for thinking about issues of justice in every case, nor that the citizens of such states really are the pertinent subjects. The effect is to destabilize the previous structure of political claims-making, and therefore to change the way in which we argue about social justice. This is true, again, for both major families of justice claims. Today, claims for redistribution increasingly eschew the assumption of national economies. Faced with transnationalized production, the outsourcing of jobs, and the associated pressures of the race to the bottom, once nationally focused labor unions look increasingly for allies abroad. Inspired by the Zapatistas, meanwhile, impoverished peasants and indigenous peoples link their struggles against despotic local and national authorities to critiques of transnational corporate predation and global neoliberalism. Finally, World Trade Organization protesters directly target the new governance structures of the global economy, which have vastly strengthened the ability of large corporations and investors to escape the regulatory and taxation powers of territorial states. In the same way, movements struggling for recognition increasingly look beyond the territorial state. Under the umbrella slogan, "Women's rights are human rights," feminists throughout the world are linking struggles against local patriarchal practices to campaigns to reform international law. Meanwhile, religious and ethnic minorities who face discrimination within territorial states are reconstituting themselves as diasporas and building transnational publics from which to mobilize international opinion. Finally, transnational coalitions of human rights activists are seeking to build new cosmopolitan institutions which can punish state violations of human dignity. In all of these cases, disputes about justice are exploding the Keynesian Westphalian frame, no longer addressed exclusively to national states or debated exclusively by national publics, claimants no longer focus solely on relations among fellow citizens. And so the grammar of argument has altered. Whether the issue is distribution or recognition, disputes that used to focus exclusively on the question of what is owed as a matter of justice to community members now turn quickly into disputes about who should count as a member and which is the relevant community. Not just the what, but also the who is up for grabs. Today, in other words, arguments about justice assume a double guise. On the one hand, they concern first-order questions of substance, just as before. How much economic inequality does justice permit? How much redistribution is required, and according to which principles of distributive justice? What constitutes equal respect? Which differences merit public recognition, and by which means? But above and beyond such first-order questions, arguments about justice today also concern second-order meta-level questions. What is the proper frame within which to consider first-order questions of justice? Who are the relevant subjects entitled to a just distribution or reciprocal recognition in a given case? Thus, it's not only the substance of justice, but also the frame that is in dispute. The result is a major challenge to our theories of social justice. Preoccupied largely with first-order issues of distribution and/or recognition, these theories have so far failed to develop conceptual resources for reflecting on the meta-issue of the frame. As things stand, it is by no means clear that they are capable of addressing the double character of problems of justice in a globalizing age. In this lecture, accordingly, I'm going to propose a strategy for thinking about the problem of the frame. I'm going to argue first that in order to deal satisfactorily with this problem, the theory of justice must become three-dimensional, incorporating the political dimension of representation alongside the economic dimension of distribution and the cultural dimension of recognition. I'm also going to argue, second, that the political dimension of representation should itself be understood as encompassing three levels. I'll explain in a minute what I mean by that. But the combined effect of these two arguments will be to make visible a third question beyond those of the what and the who. and I'll call this third question the question of the how of justice. All right. Let me begin by explaining what I mean by justice in general and by its political dimension in particular. In my view, the most general meaning of justice is parity of participation. According to this radical democratic interpretation of the classical liberal principle of equal freedom and equal moral worth, justice requires social arrangements that permit all to participate as peers in social life. Overcoming injustice means dismantling institutionalized obstacles that prevent some people from participating on a par with others as full partners in social interaction. Previously, I have analyzed two distinct kinds of obstacles to participatory parity, which correspond to two distinct species of injustice. On the one hand, people can be impeded from full participation by economic structures that deny them the resources they need in order to interact with others as peers. In that case, they suffer from distributive injustice or maldistribution. On the other hand, people can also be prevented from interacting on terms of parity by institutionalized hierarchies of cultural value that deny them the requisite standing. In that case, they suffer from status inequality or misrecognition. In the first case, the problem is the class structure of society, which corresponds to the economic dimension of justice. In the second case, the problem is the status order, which corresponds to the cultural dimension. In modern capitalist societies, the class structure and the status order do not neatly mirror each other, although, of course, they interact causally. Rather, each has some autonomy vis-a-vis the other. As a result, misrecognition cannot be reduced to a secondary effect of maldistribution, as some vulgarly economistic theories of distributive justice appear to suppose. But nor, conversely, can maldistribution be reduced to an epiphenomenal expression of misrecognition, as some equally one-sided culturalist theories of recognition tend to assume. So neither recognition theory alone nor distribution theory alone can provide an adequate understanding of justice for contemporary society. Only a two-dimensional theory encompassing both distribution and recognition can supply the necessary levels of social theoretical complexity and moral philosophical insight. That, at least, is the view of justice I have defended in the past. And this two-dimensional understanding still seems right to me as far as it goes, but I now believe that it does not go far enough. Distribution and recognition could appear to constitute the sole dimensions of justice only insofar as the Keynesian-Westphalian frame was taken for granted. Once the question of the frame becomes subject to contestation, the effect is to make visible a third dimension of justice, which was neglected in my previous work and in the work of many other philosophers. So this is a self-criticism. The third dimension of justice is the political. Now, let's be clear. Of course, distribution and recognition are themselves political in the sense of being contested and power-laden. And of course, they've usually been seen as requiring adjudication by the state. But I mean political in a more specific constitutive sense, which concerns the constitution of the state's jurisdiction and the decision rules by which it structures contestation. The political in this sense furnishes the stage on which struggles over distribution and recognition are played out, establishing criteria of social belonging and thus determining who counts as a member. The political dimension of justice specifies the reach of those other dimensions. It tells us who is included and who excluded from the circle of those entitled to a just distribution and reciprocal recognition. Establishing decision rules, likewise, the political dimension sets the procedures for staging and resolving contests in both the economic and the cultural dimensions. It tells us not only who can make claims for redistribution and recognition, but also how such claims are to be mooted and adjudicated. Centered on issues of membership and on procedure, the political dimension of justice is concerned chiefly with representation. At one level, which pertains to the boundary-setting aspect of the political, representation is a matter of social belonging. What is at issue here is inclusion in or exclusion from the community of those entitled to make justice claims on one another. At another level, which pertains to the decision rule aspect, representation concerns the procedures that structure public processes of contestation. What is at issue here are the terms on which those included in the political community air their claims and adjudicate their disputes. Now, at both levels, the question can arise as to whether the relations of representation are just. One can ask, do the boundaries of the political community wrongly exclude some who are actually entitled to representation? Do the community's decision roles accord equal voice in public deliberations and fair representation in public decision-making to all members? Such issues of representation are specifically political, conceptually distinct from both economic and cultural questions. They cannot be reduced to the latter, although, as I'll suggest, they are inextricably interwoven with them. Now, to say that the political is a conceptually distinct dimension of justice, not reducible to the economic or the cultural, is also to say that it can give rise to a conceptually distinct species of injustice. Given the view of justice as participatory parity, this means that there can be distinctively political obstacles to parity, not reducible to maldistribution or misrecognition, although again interwoven with those. Such obstacles arise from the political constitution of society, as opposed to the class structure or the status order. Grounded in a specifically political mode of social ordering, they can only be adequately grasped through a theory that conceptualizes representation along with distribution and recognition as one of three fundamental dimensions of justice. Well, if representation is the defining issue of the political dimension, then the characteristic political injustice is misrepresentation. Misrepresentation occurs when political boundaries and/or decision rules function to wrongly deny some people the possibility of participating on a par with others in social and political arenas. Far from being reducible to maldistribution or misrecognition, misrepresentation can occur, at least in principle, even in the absence of the latter injustices, although, as I say, it is usually intertwined with them. Now, at least two different levels of misrepresentation can be distinguished. Insofar as political decision rules wrongly deny some of the included the chance to participate fully as peers, the injustice is what I shall call ordinary political misrepresentation. Here, where the issue is intra-frame representation, we enter the familiar terrain of political science debates over the relative merits of alternative electoral systems. Do single-member district winner-take-all first-past-the-post systems unjustly deny parity to numerical minorities? And if so, is proportional representation or cumulative voting the appropriate remedy? Likewise, do gender-blind rules in conjunction with gender-based maldistribution and misrecognition function to deny parity of political participation to women? And if so, are gender quotas an appropriate remedy? I see Ann Phillips is sitting here. She's written quite a lot about this question. Such questions belong to the sphere of what I am calling ordinary political justice, which has usually been played out within the Keynesian-Westphalian frame. Less obvious, perhaps, is a second level of misrepresentation, which concerns the boundary-setting aspect of the political. Here, the injustice arises when the community's boundaries are drawn in such a way as to wrongly exclude some people from the chance to participate at all in its authorized contests over justice. In such cases, misrepresentation takes a deeper form, which I shall call misframing. The deeper character of misframing is a function of the crucial importance of framing to every question of social justice. Far from being of marginal importance, frame setting is among the most consequential of political decisions. Constituting both members and non-members in a single stroke, this decision effectively excludes the latter from the universe of those entitled to consideration within the community in matters of distribution, recognition, and ordinary political representation. The result can be a serious injustice. When questions of justice are framed in a way that wrongly excludes some from consideration, the consequence is a special kind of meta-injustice in which one is denied the chance to press first-order justice claims in a given political community. The injustice remains, moreover, even when those excluded from one political community are included as subjects of justice in another, as long as the effect of the political division is to put some relevant aspects of justice beyond their reach. And I'll give some examples in just a little while of that. Still more serious, of course, is the case in which one is excluded from membership in any political community. Akin to the loss of what Hannah Arendt called the right to have rights, that sort of misframing is a kind of political death. Those who suffer it may become objects of charity or benevolence, but deprived of the possibility of ordering first-order claims, they become non-persons with respect to justice. Now, it's the misframing form of recognition that globalization has recently begun to make visible. Earlier, in the heyday of the post-war welfare state, with the Keynesian-Westphalian frame securely in place, the principal concern in thinking about justice was distribution. Later, with the rise of the new social movements and multiculturalism, the center of gravity shifted to recognition. In both cases, however, the modern territorial state was normally assumed by default. As a result, the political dimension of justice was relegated to the margins. Where it did emerge, it took the ordinary political form of contests over the decision rules internal to the polity, whose boundaries were largely taken for granted. Thus, claims for gender quotas and multicultural rights sought to remove political obstacles to participatory parity for those who were already included in principle in the political community. Taking for granted the Keynesian-Westphalian frame, they did not necessarily call into question the assumption that the appropriate unit of justice was the territorial state. Today, in contrast, what I'm calling globalization, has put the question of the frame squarely on the political agenda. Increasingly subject to contestation, the Keynesian-Westphalian frame is now considered by many to be a major vehicle of injustice, as it partitions political space in ways that block many who are poor and despised from challenging the forces that oppress them. Channeling their claims into the domestic political spaces of relatively powerless, if not wholly failed, states, this frame insulates offshore powers from critique and control. Among those shielded from the reach of justice are more powerful predator states and transnational private powers, including foreign investors and creditors, international currency speculators, and transnational corporations. Also protected are the governance structures of the global economy, which set exploitative terms of interaction and then exempt them from democratic control. Finally, the Keynesian-Westphalian frame is self-insulating. The architecture of the interstate system protects the very partitioning of political space that it institutionalizes, effectively excluding transnational democratic decision-making on issues of justice. Well, seen from this perspective, the Keynesian-Westphalian frame appears to to be a powerful instrument of injustice, which gerrymanders political space at the expense of the poor and the despised. For those persons who are denied the chance to press transnational first-order claims, struggles against maldistribution and misrecognition cannot proceed, let alone succeed, unless they are joined with struggles against misframing. It is not surprising, therefore, that some people consider misframing the defining injustice of a globalizing age. Under these conditions of heightened awareness of misframing, the political dimension of justice is hard to ignore. Insofar as globalization is politicizing the question of the frame, it is also making visible an aspect of the grammar of justice that was often neglected in the previous period. It is now apparent that no claim for justice can avoid presupposing some notion of representation, implicit or explicit, insofar as none can avoid assuming a frame. Thus, representation is always already inherent in all claims for redistribution and recognition. The political dimension is implicit in, indeed required by, the very grammar of the concept of justice. Thus, no redistribution or recognition without representation. In general, then, an adequate theory of justice for our time must be three-dimensional, encompassing not only redistribution and recognition, but also representation. It must allow us to grasp the question of the frame as a question of justice. Incorporating the economic, cultural, and political dimensions, it must enable us to identify injustices of misframing and to evaluate possible remedies. Above all, it must permit us to pose and to answer what I take to be the key political question of our age: how can we integrate struggles against maldistribution, misrecognition, and misrepresentation within a post-Westphalian, post-Keynesian frame? Okay, so far I have been arguing for the irreducible specificity of the political as one of three fundamental dimensions of justice, and I've identified two distinct levels of political injustice: ordinary political misrepresentation and misframing. Now I want to turn to what I'll call the politics of framing in a globalizing world. Distinguishing affirmative from transformative approaches, I'm going to argue that an adequate politics of representation must also address a third level. Beyond contesting ordinary political misrepresentation on the one hand and misframing on the other, such a politics must also aim to democratize the process of frame setting. Now, let me begin by explaining what I mean by the politics of framing. Situated at my second level, where distinctions between members and non-members are drawn, this politics concerns the boundary-setting aspect of the political. Focused on the issues of who counts as a subject of justice and what is the appropriate frame, the politics of framing comprises efforts to establish and consolidate, or to contest and revise, the authoritative division of political space. Included here are struggles against misframing, which aim to dismantle the obstacles that prevent disadvantaged people from confronting the forces that oppress them with claims of justice. Centered on the setting and contesting of frames, the politics of framing is concerned with the question of the who. Now, the politics of framing can take two distinct forms, both of which I think are actually being practiced today in our globalizing world. The first approach, which I shall call the affirmative politics of framing, contests the boundaries of existing frames while accepting the Westphalian grammar of frame setting. In this politics, those who claim to suffer injustices of misframing seek to redraw the boundaries of existing territorial states, or in some cases, to create new ones. But they still assume that the territorial state is the appropriate unit within which to pose and resolve disputes about justice. For them, accordingly, injustices of misframing are not a function of the general principle according to which the Westphalian order partitions political space. They arise, rather, as a result of the faulty way in which that principle has been applied. So, those who practice the affirmative politics of framing accept that the principle of what we might call state territoriality is the proper basis for constituting the who of justice. They agree, in other words, that what makes a given collection of individuals into fellow subjects of justice is their shared residence on the territory of a modern state and/or their shared membership in the political community that corresponds to such a state. So far from challenging the underlying grammar of the Westphalian order, those who practice the affirmative politics of framing accept its state-territorial principle. Precisely that principle is contested, however, in a second version of the politics of framing, which I'll call the transformative approach. For proponents of this approach, the state-territorial principle no longer affords an adequate basis for determining the who of justice in every case. Now, supporters of this approach might concede that that principle remains relevant for some, even for many purposes, and they may not propose to eliminate state territoriality entirely. But they contend that its grammar is out of sync with the structural causes of many injustices in a globalizing world, which are not territorial in character. Examples include the financial markets, offshore factories and investment regimes, and governance structures of the global economy, which determine who works for a wage and who does not. The information networks of global media and cyber technology, which determine who is included in the circuits of communicative power and who is not. And the biopolitics of climate, disease, drugs, weapons, and biotechnology, which determine who will live long and who will die young. In these matters, which are so fundamental to human well-being, the forces that perpetrate injustice belong not to the space of places, but to the space of flows, to use Manuel Castells' terminology. Not locatable within the jurisdiction of any actual or even conceivable territorial state, these forces cannot be made answerable to claims of justice that are framed in terms of the state-territorial principle. In their case, so the argument goes, to invoke the state-territorial principle to determine the frame is itself to commit an injustice. By partitioning political space along territorial lines, this principle insulates extra and non-territorial powers from the reach of justice. In a globalizing world, therefore, it is less likely to serve as a remedy for misframing than as a means of inflicting or perpetrating it. In general, then, the transformative politics of framing aims to change the deep grammar of frame setting in a globalizing world. This approach seeks to supplement, if not to replace, the state-territorial principle of the Westphalian order with one or more post-Westphalian principles. The aim is to overcome injustices of misframing by changing not just the boundaries of the who of justice, but also the mode of their constitution, in other words, the way in which they are drawn. What might a post-Westphalian mode of frame setting look like? Doubtless it's too early to have a clear view. I certainly don't have. Nevertheless, the most promising candidate so far is a version of the so-called all-affected principle. This principle holds that all those affected by a given social structure or institution have moral standing as subjects of justice in relation to it. On this view, what turns a collection of people into fellow subjects of justice is not geographical proximity, but their co-imbrication in a common structural or institutional framework, which sets the ground rules that govern their social interaction, thereby shaping their respective life possibilities in patterns of advantage and disadvantage. Until recently, the all-affected principle seemed to coincide in the eyes of many with the state-territorial principle. It was assumed, in keeping with the Westphalian world picture, that the common framework that determined patterns of advantage and disadvantage was precisely the constitutional order of the modern territorial state. As a result, it seemed that in applying the state territorial principle, one simultaneously captured the normative force of the all-affected principle. In fact, this was never truly so, as the long history of colonialism and neocolonialism attests. From the perspective of the metropole, however, the conflation of state territoriality with what we might call social effectivity appeared to have an emancipatory thrust, as it served to justify the progressive incorporation, as subjects of justice, of the subordinate classes and status groups who were resident on the territory but excluded from active citizenship. Today, however, the idea that state territoriality can serve as a proxy for social effectivity is no longer plausible. Under current conditions, one's chances to live a good life do not depend wholly on the internal political constitution of the territorial state in which one resides. Although the latter remains undeniably relevant, its effects are mediated by other structures, both extra and non-territorial, whose impact is at least as significant. In general, then, globalization is driving a widening wedge between state territoriality and social effectivity. As those two principles, or as the force of those two principles, increasingly diverge, the effect is to reveal the former as an inadequate surrogate for the latter. And so the question arises, is it possible to apply the all-affected principle directly to the framing of justice without going through the detour of state territoriality? This is precisely, I think, what some practitioners of transformative politics are seeking to do. Searching for leverage against offshore sources of maldistribution and misrecognition, some globalization activists are appealing directly to the all-affected principle in order to circumvent the state-territorial partitioning of political space. Contesting their exclusion by the Keynesian-Westphalian frame, environmentalists and indigenous peoples are claiming standing as subjects of justice in relation to the extra and non-territorial powers that impact their lives. Insisting that effectivity trumps state territoriality, they have joined development activists, international feminists, and others in asserting their right to make claims against the structures that harm them, even when the latter cannot be located in the space of places. Casting off the Westphalian grammar of frame setting, these claimants are applying the all-affected principle directly to questions of justice in a globalizing world. In such cases, the transformative politics of framing proceeds simultaneously in multiple dimensions and on multiple levels. On one level, the social movements that practice this politics aim to redress first-order injustices of maldistribution, misrecognition, and ordinary political misrepresentation. On a second level, they seek to redress meta-level injustices of misframing by reconstituting the who of justice. In those cases, moreover, where the state-territorial principle serves more to indemnify than to challenge injustice, transformative social movements appeal instead, as I've just noted, to the all-affected principle. Invoking a post-Westphalian principle, they are seeking to change the very grammar of frame setting and thereby to reconstruct what we might call the metapolitical foundations of justice for a globalizing world. But the claims of transformative politics go further still. In addition to appealing to a post-Westphalian principle, this politics is also inaugurating a post-Westphalian process of frame setting. Above and beyond their other claims, these movements are also, in effect, claiming a say in the process of frame setting. Rejecting the standard view, which deems frame setting the prerogatives of states, international organizations, intergovernmental organizations, and transnational elites, they are effectively aiming to democratize the process by which the frames of justice are drawn and revised. asserting their right to participate in constituting the who of justice, they are simultaneously transforming the how, by which I mean the accepted procedures for determining the who. At their most reflective and ambitious, accordingly, transformative movements are demanding the creation of new democratic arenas for entertaining arguments about the frame. In some cases, moreover, they are creating such arenas themselves. In the World Social Forum, for example, some practitioners of transformative politics have fashioned a transnational public sphere where they hope to participate on a par with others in airing and resolving disputes about the frame. Of course, this is not a sphere that has any institutional authority, but it's an interesting experiment, one which I think prefigures the possibility of new institutions of post-Westphalian democratic justice. The democratizing dimension of transformative politics points to a third level of political injustice above and beyond the two I previously discussed. Previously, I distinguished first-order injustices of ordinary political misrepresentation from second-order injustices of misframing. Now, however, we can discern a third-order species of political injustice, which corresponds to this question of the how. Exemplified by undemocratic processes of frame-setting, this injustice consists in the failure to institutionalize parity of participation at the metapolitical level in deliberations and decisions concerning the who. Because what is at stake here is the process by which first-order political space is constituted, I shall call this injustice metapolitical misrepresentation. Metapolitical misrepresentation arises when states and transnational elites monopolize the activity of frame-setting, denying voice to those who may be harmed in the process, and blocking creation of democratic fora where the latter's claims can be vetted and redressed. The effect is to exclude the overwhelming majority of people, even relatively privileged people such as us, from participation in the meta-discourses that determine the authoritative division of political space. Lacking any institutional arenas for such participation and submitted to an undemocratic approach to the how, the majority is denied the chance to engage on terms of parity in decision-making about the who. In general, then, struggles against misframing are revealing a new kind of democratic deficit. Just as globalization has made visible injustices of misframing, so transformative struggles against neoliberal globalization are making visible the injustice of metapolitical misrepresentation, exposing the lack of institutions where disputes about the who can be democratically aired and resolved. These struggles are focusing attention on the how. By demonstrating that the absence of such institutions impedes efforts to overcome injustice, they are revealing the deep internal connections between democracy and justice. The effect is to bring to light a structural feature of the current conjuncture. Struggles for justice in a globalizing world cannot succeed unless they go hand in hand with struggles for metapolitical democracy. At this level, too, then, no redistribution or recognition without representation. Well, I've been arguing that what distinguishes the current conjuncture is intensified contestation concerning both the who and the how of justice. Under these conditions, the theory of justice itself is undergoing a paradigm shift. Earlier, when the Keynesian-Westphalian frame was in place, most philosophers neglected the political dimension. Treating the territorial state as a given, they endeavored to ascertain the requirements of justice, theoretically, in a monological fashion. Thus, they did not envision any role in determining those requirements for those who would be subject to them, let alone for those who would be excluded by the national frame. Neglecting to reflect on the question of the frame, these philosophers, myself included, never imagined that those whose fates would be so decisively shaped by framing decisions might be entitled to participate in making them. disavowing any need for a dialogical democratic moment. They were content, as I said, to produce monological theories of justice. Today, however, monological theories of social justice are becoming increasingly implausible. As we've seen, globalization problematizes the question of the how, even as it politicizes the question of the who. The process goes something like this. As the circle of those claiming a say in frame setting expands, decisions about the who are increasingly viewed as political matters, which should be handled democratically, rather than as technical matters that can be left to experts and elites. The effect is to shift the burden of argument, requiring defenders of expert privilege to make their case. No longer able to hold themselves above the fray, they are necessarily embroiled in disputes about the how. As a result, they must contend with demands for what I called meta-political misrepresentation. Sorry, meta-political democratization. Now, an analogous shift, I think, is currently making itself felt in normative philosophy. Just as some activists are seeking to transfer elite frame-setting prerogatives to democratic publics, so some theorists of justice are proposing to rethink the classic division of labor between theorist and demos. No longer content to ascertain the requirements of justice in a monological fashion, such theorists are looking increasingly to dialogical approaches, which treat important aspects of justice as matters for collective decision-making to be determined by the citizens themselves through democratic deliberation. For them, accordingly, the grammar of the theory of justice is being transformed. What was once called the theory of social justice now appears as the theory of democratic justice, to use Ian Shapiro's very apt phrase. In its current form, however, the theory of democratic justice remains incomplete. To complete the shift from a monological to a dialogical theory requires a further step beyond those envisioned by Shapiro and other proponents of the dialogical turn. Henceforth, democratic processes of determination must be applied not only to the what of justice, but also to the who and the how. In that case, by adopting a democratic approach, the theory of justice assumes a guise appropriate to a globalizing world. Dialogical at every level, metapolitical as well as ordinary political, it becomes what I've called a theory of post-Westphalian democratic justice. I think that the view of justice that I've defended as parity of participation lends itself easily to such an approach. This principle has a double quality that expresses the reflexive character of democratic justice. On the one hand, the principle of participatory parity is an outcome notion, which specifies a substantive principle of justice by which we may evaluate social arrangements. Social arrangements are just if and only if they permit all the relevant social actors to participate as peers in social life. But on the other hand, participatory parity is also a process notion, which specifies a procedural standard by which we may evaluate the democratic legitimacy of norms. Norms are legitimate if and only if they can command the assent of all concerned in fair and open processes of deliberation in which all can participate as peers. By virtue of this double quality, the view of justice as participatory parity has an inherent reflexivity. Able to problematize both substance and procedure, it renders visible the mutual entwinement of those two aspects of social arrangements. Thus, this approach can expose both the unjust background conditions that skew putatively democratic decision-making and the undemocratic procedures that generate substantively unequal outcomes. As a result, it enables us to shift levels easily, moving back and forth as necessary between first-order and meta-level questions, making manifest the co-implication of democracy and justice. The view of justice as participatory parity supplies just the sort of reflexivity that I think is needed in a globalizing world. Well, let me conclude by recalling the principal features of the theory of justice that I have sketched here. And of course, it's only a sketch. An account of post-Westphalian democratic justice. This theory encompasses three fundamental dimensions: economic, cultural, and political. As a result, it renders visible and criticizable the mutual entwinement of maldistribution, misrecognition, and misrepresentation. In addition, this theory's account of political injustice encompasses three levels, addressing not only ordinary political misrepresentation, but also misframing and metapolitical misrepresentation. It allows us to grasp the problem of the frame as a matter of justice, focused not only on the what of justice, but also on the who and the how. It enables us to evaluate the justice of alternative principles and alternative processes of frame setting. Above all, as I noted before, the theory of post-Westphalian democratic justice encourages us to pose, and hopefully to answer, the key political question of our time. How can we integrate struggles against maldistribution, misrecognition, and misrepresentation within a post-Westphalian frame? Thank you very much.
Nancy, thank you for such a far-reaching, comprehensive, thought-provoking and profound talk. Some students have to nip off now to dinner, but for those who will stay for another, we have half an hour for discussion. We usually take them in the middle of our lecture series in clusters of five questions, but since the material is quite complex, why don't we try and take clusters of three and see how we go. And hands up. Excellent. Well, let me just start with Anne and then we'll go up there. Yes. Anne Phillips.
Okay, well, thanks. That was a very ambitious and very interesting reframing of the questions of justice. And I have a worry, which I think is a kind of Miliband worry, though I may be misrepresenting him in this. It seems to me you're kind of, I mean, what you're saying is there's a mismatch between taking the nation, the citizens in a nation state, as the people who debate and discuss issues of justice, and actually who is in fact affected by particular kinds of decisions. So I presume one example would be, it's decided to have various kinds of subsidies for cotton production in one country, but actually the people affected by that may be many, many people's livelihoods, many parts of the world. Okay, I mean, that's a very compelling point and absolutely right, but I kind of worry that, in a way, you've then overstated the importance of representation, because say you actually managed to get a situation where everyone affected was able to have a voice, or even if you could imagine some institutions in which everyone affected had a vote, you've still got the fact that the economic power which lies behind that decision, which isn't in fact sort of, it's not just a question of how many people can have a voice or how many people have a vote, because you've still got the kind of the extraordinary power of particular companies. This is why I think it's a Miliband point, who are able to continue pursuing the policies that they want anyway.
Nancy, I've got sort of two points up here.
Okay, thank you.
the first one concerns your characterization of the Westphalian Keynesian model. It's very easy to be against the current state system, but one of the advantages of something that looks like a state system is that it gives you a site of responsibility. There is a return address to which you can direct your claims for just treatment. And what seems to be missing in your account of inclusion and so on is some sense of where your claims for justice are being addressed. This is a dialogue amongst ourselves about what we want or what our claims should be, but there's no sense of who do we direct them to. Now, if it's these sort of moving sites of power, I mean, what do we do about them? You know, there has to be some point at which we can address our grievances, our claims of justice. A second point, also to do with boundaries, has to do with the question of how you set the boundaries to the group who's affected, whose interests are affected. Because it's not clear to me that even in the example that Anne gave, where there's some kind of economic inequality on a global level in relation to some particular industry, those who are affected are easily identifiable. And if you can't give some clear answer to that, then it seems to me you've got to bring in some account of equality of voice as a way of filtering, so that you don't have groups saying, well, we define who's the group that is being affected, and it's only our say and not these other people who think they're being affected but actually aren't being affected. So it's this question again of how you identify boundaries even on your new model, and that can't be a self-identification.
I'm just wondering whether your argument about the continuing power of the Westphalian frame in relation to the creation of injustice might lead you to the conclusion that the forces of globalization have actually been overstated. And what I particularly have in mind is the somewhat limited reach of human rights claims, which are ultimately to be delivered through the machinery of the nation state.
I mean, Nancy, that's three very substantial questions, but people are queuing up.
That's fine.
Would you be happy to take a couple more?
I can do it either way. Do.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll just take a couple more, and then we'll...
I actually have two related questions. The first one is to do with connecting your three elements of justice to the very present international agenda this year. There are three big international reports on the agenda at the UN this year. There's the high-level panel on threat, security and change, which can be broadly, there's a sort of a broad analogy with recognition. There's the Sachs report on development, which is broadly connected to distribution. There is also the Cardoso report on the inclusion of civil society in decision making, and that can be broadly connected to your third element of political justice. And my first question is, if you can sort of accept that broad analogy, in the practical sense, they're very much have been put in a hierarchy. So my question is, how can you actually make these into three equal spheres? How can we make these three elements of justice equal? My second question is that the debate about globalization seems to assume a misframed concept of the state itself. For example, in international law and international relations, we talk about the state because the state is the basic legal unit in international terms, and we talk about the state as the vehicle for injustice. But actually, underneath that corporate veil, what we're really talking about is governments, and there's often a distinction between governments and, for example, parliamentarians. There is a huge movement at the moment to include parliamentarians in decision-making on international issues. Three very quick anecdotes. The first is that, I won't give you the anecdotes, but my second question then is, if we want to improve participation and political justice on the global level, surely we shouldn't be talking about trying to get rid of the state, but actually how we change the structure within the state.
We'll stop at those five.
That's it.
No, there's one more
coming.
Okay.
Okay, good.
I have two questions. The first one, I'll try and be brief. The first one is I guess my feeling of suspicion around characterizing what you're talking about as something new. And I think I can ask that best by saying I want to challenge, I guess, the characterization of these three things that you outlined as mutually entwined, whereas I would see them as mutually constitutive: recognition, claims for redistribution, and then the third dimension that you outlined, the question of the meta frame, or the question of framing. And you mentioned indigenous peoples, and I think that this becomes very clear when we look at the struggles of indigenous peoples in colonial settler societies, because for the last couple of hundred years, the claims being made by indigenous peoples combine all three of those things very, very clearly. So to say that they're mutually related but yet separate, I think, takes us down a certain path of analysis that ignores a history of colonialism, in a sense. And the second question is, when you were talking about some of the things happening now in terms of politics and organizing, and the things that you mentioned seem to elide the question of citizenship. And when it comes to the question of deciding who is in and who is out, I just wanted to ask a more concrete question about, do you think that the territorial borders of the nation state should be brought into question, and how does this impact immigration policies and refugee policies?
Wow, I mean, that's a lot of questions. A lot of serious issues, both of theory and of application of the theory. 2 minutes?
Two minutes.
The less,
the better.
Let's give you
five. I can't begin to answer any of these. They're really deep and important questions, all of them. But I'll try to say a little about each of them. Anne Phillips is actually absolutely right to say that the question isn't just figuring out a way in which everyone affected can have a vote, but also some kind of constitution of possible political authority that is right seen as having the legitimate authority to regulate or govern the kinds of economic powers that you're talking about. I mean, you gave an example of, which is a good example, of a decision of national policy to subsidize, right, a national industry that can have very deleterious effects on poor farmers in Africa or wherever. Okay, that's one kind of a problem where the issue is what the state is doing and who's being taken into account and who has a say and so on. But there are other issues where the what one wants to deal with, and one does need an addressee, and I'll come to that in a minute, is to exercise state-like authority over a private economic power, for example, a transnational corporation. All of the same kinds of issues of the scope of governing authority, using politics to tame markets, whatever you want to call these, because you mentioned this in relation to economic powers, public powers, authority to curb private power, all of those same issues which we're very familiar with within the territorial state arise again now at this other level. So I don't think that I've proposed any answer to how to think about that question, but you're absolutely right. The question is crucial, and it relates to Paul Kelly's question about an addressee. And absolutely, one of the things that is so crucial now about our age, and David has written about this quite a bit, is that in some cases we have something like transnational civil society movements and debates and discussions and contestation, but we lack the formal institutional track. I mean, I'm assuming something like what Habermas would call a two-track model of politics, right? A civil society track and a formal institutional track. Now, with respect to the transnational or even global aspects, we have, I think, the civil society track to some degree outstripping the formal institutional track. So I didn't at all mean to suggest that something like the World Social Forum alone is, provides the answer to any of this, but it just struck me that it's something about that is making a claim. Maybe it's not explicit, but I think we can unpack it as making a claim that there ought to be formal institutions where these kinds of issues can be vetted and take binding authoritative decisions. Institutions where those who make a claim to being affected but excluded have standing to make those claims, to make their case. I agree with you also about the great difficulty of what it would mean to actually set boundaries democratically. I mean, we seem to immediately be into the democratic paradox, some kind of regress, and so on. And I'm only at the beginning of trying to think that through, but I'll just mention an essay that made a big impression on me, Thomas Paga's essay, How to Create Supranational Institutions Democratically. I don't know if you know it, but he actually imagines a process by which the EU might have, was not, but might have been democratically designed. So I do believe that the democratic paradox, we've just used it too much as a conversation stopper. I think that there may be ways to finesse some of these issues. Yes, the question about have some of the theories or literature about globalization overstated the strength of the transnational and the weakness of the state. My hunch is that that we probably have not overstated the strength of the sort of corporate economic side of things, but it's true that the human rights, you could call it, you know, the good side of globalization, is at the level of implementation, enforcement, and so on, are of course quite weak. The hope is that those powers can be strengthened vis-a-vis states. I don't know what to say about the three UN reports and whether they correspond to my three dimensions. I sort of would guess that maybe one could say that there's one of these dimensions is a little bit dominant in each of the three, but I suspect that for the development, for example, clearly involves the interimbrication of not just distribution, but these other dimensions as well. So, again, I think from your question, I can tell that you know much more about what's going on in these UN reports than I do. So, I don't think I can say anything more about that. Let's see, the other question, yeah. I think you also asked about talking about parliamentarians and not just sort of reifying the state, but looking at the different agencies and governing processes and so on of the state. And of course, the parliamentary is and possibly the judicial are, you know, two that are I think, you know, especially interesting from the standpoint of democratic theory. But again, I think I want to say to you the same thing that I said to Anne. All of these problems about how to again, if I could use Habermas language, how to connect the communicative power of that should be transmitted from civil society through parliament, how to connect that up with the administrative dimension or even the judicial dimension. These are problems of for democratic theorists within the territorial state, and they remain problems, but even harder and even more complicated problems once we try to think about politics beyond the territorial state. Let's see. Yes, the question about colonialism, indigenous peoples, and the relations among my three dimensions. I see these three dimensions these are analytical distinctions, and the whole point of my originally two-dimensional theory, now three-dimensional theory, is to create an analytical framework for understanding precisely how these things are entwined in the real world. So I don't disagree with you at all in saying that struggles of indigenous peoples have all three of these things in them. In fact, I think most feminist struggles have more than one of these things, often three of them going on, many, many actual struggles, if not all, involve all of these. Whether one should say that they're mutually constitutive versus mutually entwined, I'm not sure. I mean, that might be a somewhat technical question, and we could think about it. I mean, what I said here today, when I said that the representation dimension was always already inherent in, maybe that should be unpacked as is partially constitutive of. So I'm not sure exactly what hinges on that difference of terminology. It's worth thinking about. But I did not mean to suggest that what can be distinguished analytically is separated in social reality. I don't think I can say anything useful about immigration and refugee policy, or at least not anything that somehow derives in a theoretically convincing way from the framework that I've developed here. But I do know that this is something I need to think about. I'm going to duck it. I think that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, okay. We need to finish it at 8. So anyone, a couple more people with urgent short questions. Urgent long questions will have to wait. Short questions. Anybody want to? Yes, please. Short.
Thank you. I think you may have in part already answered this, but I was struck by the extent to which when you were talking about the dialogic basis for representation, for participatory parity, it was just so resonant with Habermas's notion of the ideal speech situation, or indeed the way that Habermas's sort of opposite number colleague, Carl Otto Apel, has talked about global communication communities and has sought to concretize that notion of the ideal speech situation. And I suppose my question is, to what extent is that resonance conscious or accidental? But you've already been referring to Habermas, and I'm kind of reckoning that maybe you're going to say, yes, you're seeking to develop this notion.
One final short question over there.
Yeah, thank you for a very interesting lecture. I should like to ask you, it's normally a very good principle to try one's theory on the tradition, and in this case the political philosophical tradition, and there I should like to know what your result is when you are trying to reflect it. It's not, of course, difficult to do that in short terms, but just to say a little bit about it, because my problem by your presentation is that if I take the big names in the political philosophical traditions, I think many of them would say that your theory is very idealistic. I mean, even Kant, the super idealist, he would say that it was too hard for him. How do you reflect this problem yourself?
Okay. Let me answer that one, and raise one or two other brief questions since I'll address myself to that one. If you just think historically of the context in which Machiavelli, Hobbes, and Locke were writing, it was against the most unpromising conditions for the development of a theory of the modern state that sought to define political power separate from rule and ruled, that sought to circumscribe the nature of political authority, that ought to embed a set of political ways of thinking that separated church and state and so on. So you could have said that Leviathan was a great utopian text, and in some sense it was. But the great power of the idea of the modern state and impartiality was that over time it rechiseled and refashioned the way people thought about power and politics, giving way from power and brute power to concepts of modern authority. So time is a critical dimension in answering the question that you just raised. I mean, Machiavelli, Hobbes and Locke were all, not necessarily Machiavelli, but certainly Hobbes and Locke were idealists in the context when they were writing, and yet, over time, we might now say today, over 150, 200, 250 years, their ideas reconstituted what it was to think about modern politics. So in that sense, I'm with you completely, as you know. But let me just ask you then, having said that, just a couple of questions on my own. One is, it seems to me very striking that the theory of democracy has gone through the same debate over the last 10, 15 years as the theory of justice. Is there a convergence here? Because in many senses, this debate about the contours and boundaries of democracy has been had for the last 10 to 15 years. And I just wonder now whether the theory of justice and the theory of democracy are, in your view, becoming sort of mutually reconstituting themselves. Secondly, I think having said that, we do have to recognize that in the short term, certainly, and historically where we are, many of the most virulent political disputes are still sovereign-based and territorial. I mean, from the Middle East to Kashmir, from the Balkans to Sub-Saharan Africa, from even the debates about the EU constitution today, there are still debates about the nature and boundaries of sovereignty, territoriality, and so on. You know, go to the Middle East and say territory doesn't matter as much as what people once thought, and the argument won't go very far. So I think that the argument has to somehow meet the argument in ideal terms, somehow has to also meet the geopolitical reality where the clash over sovereignty and territory is still, of course, very intensive. Now, it seems to me the issue there is, the theoretical issue that has to be grappled with is the issue of ultimately borders and the normative and ideological, theoretical basis of thinking, philosophical basis of thinking about borders. Now, of course, the old state tradition hasn't got that much to offer here, because most of those debates were settled through warfare, dispute, through all sorts of mechanisms which were not meeting the standards of the ideal speech situation, but were the geopolitics of their time and so on. And these disputes define what we took borders to mean and settled them in international law, at least for a very long time. But the principle of the all affected and so on, which is at the heart, I think, what you were trying to argue, I don't think will get us very far. In fact, it's because it's so broad, it tends to risk paralysis. If you have to meet the claim that every time you make a decision, you have to deal and negotiate with all those affected, in some sense, it seems to me, no decision could ever be taken, in some senses. So we need to differentiate ranges of decisions that matter. And there, contrary to some skepticism, I think you're on the right lines. But I think we need to circumscribe it. There are different levels of impact, impact on vital needs and interests. The common market agricultural policy, the cotton subsidies, they kill people. We can identify the nature of that subsidy, the nature of the intervention, and the nature of the result. So if you circumscribe that principle to vital needs and interests, it does quite a lot of work already for you in a theory of justice or a theory of democratic borders. If you extend it upwards to Weber, life chances and life opportunities, it begins to get messier. And if you extend it to culture and lifestyle chances, the impact of soaps on one culture or another, let's say that's so contested, it becomes more difficult. But I think that's where the theoretical work needs to be done. If the principle is to deliver, I think it has to be circumscribed. And I would like see you in the future, perhaps, working more in that direction. What do you think, Nancy? Yeah.
Great. Okay, let me try to say something again to all three of you. I am in a kind of a dialogue, sometimes explicit and sometimes implicit, with Habermas. Habermas's discourse principle, if you recall, is that a norm is justified if and if it can meet with the unconstrained discursive assent of all affected. But Habermas never paid attention to that all affected. It's in the definition, but it's not anything he ever worked out, because originally, of course, in his theory, like everybody else's, just, you know, assumed some kind of a bounded social unit that we didn't have to theorize. So I think what I'm trying to do is pull out something that is implicit, or and, you know, raise a question about it that he didn't fully raise. The other way in which I'm in a kind of a semi-critical dialogue with him is that I want to spell out much more concretely exactly what are the social, cultural, and now political conditions for parity of participation in discourse. Okay, so that's the sort of line of discussion. I couldn't improve on David's answer about idealism, so I'll leave it at that. I do see myself broadly as a Hegelian in the sense of trying to grasp one's time in thought, and it seems to me these are among the burning political issues that require new conceptualizations. And I hope that you are right that a few hundred years from now they'll seem quite
less
ordinary.
Nancy, less.
We'll see. Okay. Now, David, I do believe there is a kind of convergence between democratic theory and the theory of justice. And it, because I find that when I start out working from justice, I end up at a place very near where you and others who start out from the theory of democracy end up. And what I really meant to say, in a way, in the very last part of the paper about this sort of paradigm shift in normative philosophy in general, was the growing sense of the mutual presupposition of justice and democracy, the impossibility of thinking about either one of those without also thinking about the other, so that my argument would be vis-a-vis the theory of democracy, and it's just to repeat the point I just made, is that we don't have democracy unless we can really spell out the social conditions under which there is equal voice. So we're involved in justice. On the other hand, the other side of the circle is that we can't, in many cases, know exactly concretely what justice requires until we've heard from many voices that are often not heard from. So yes, there is a convergence, but also a kind of analytical mutual interdependence of the theories at the level of the concepts. Of course, there's a continuing virulence of territorial disputes, which is why I wanted to say that there is also this what I call the affirmative politics of framing, and I don't for a moment deny that. I tried to talk about that there are really two different kinds of politics of framing going on, and one of them really is using the state territorial principle. And I don't mean at all to suggest that there's something invalid or whatever. No, those issues certainly continue to matter. Nevertheless, I would say that let us take the hardest case or something. Let's assume that the Palestinians get a viable state go back to the Green Line or something, a real viable territorial state, that will still leave all of these other kinds of issues to do with neoliberalism and transnational corporate, all of the questions that you are yourself interested in. So, the question is that these are both crucial dimensions. And yes, I agree with you that the all affected principle just by itself doesn't help. Given the so-called butterfly effect, it can be interpreted as everybody is affected by everything. So what counts is some sort of way of distinguishing those kinds and levels of effectiveness or effectivity that are sufficient to confer moral standing. Carol Gould has suggested that one could cash this out in terms of if one's fundamental human rights are affected, then of course we need an account of what that means. But okay, so there is some work for theorists to do here. But I also want to suggest that even if we could come up with a theoretically defensible interpretation that circumscribed the all effect, its application is still going to be something that is reasonably contestable, and that we're still going to need institutions for arguing about whether the standard is met or not. So again, I don't think there's a monologically neat theoretical answer. I would still want to put it through the dialogical turn, or at least find an institutionalized space where the dialogical moment is given its due.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much. The next Miliband lecture is in 2 weeks' time, outside the inequalities series, but we have Robert Reich coming, reflecting on contemporary American politics. Watch the news sports.